Right, I'll reconvene the hearing. Ms. Jones, asking 12211, perhaps first, were you the author of the zone provisions?
By and large, yes.
Yes, that's fine. So policy 12211, and it talks about providing for greater site coverage. Greater than what?
A good point. In my mind, of course, greater than what is in the ODP, which is irrelevant. I still think there's merit in the policy that we need to read, providing for, you know, high degree of site coverage or
Okay, well, I'm happy if you think there's ability to amend that. And you could look at the use of the word additional as well, which follows four words later. Then the next policy, it seems to talk about development, commercial development opportunities that are affordable relative to those in the core. How does the plan make them affordable? I don't see anything in the rules that lead.
Well, simply by zoning them to a new use. Essentially upzoning them from residential to town centre, which enables residential density plus the commercial, yet they are on the periphery, so they're going to be
lower
value than the high pedestrian flow.
Right, so it's only a function of the limitation of the rules.
It's a function of having rezoned them and planning that to a higher yield use, I guess.
I'm not quite sure I follow. Were they zoned residential before?
Some were zoned town centre, some were zoned residential.
Yeah. If they were zoned town residential before and they're now zoned town centre. That, as I understand it, though, that's not, it's actually a geographic comparison, not a temporal comparison. What I'm trying to understand, is it the limitations in that area limit the land values?
It is that as well, because they only get 75% coverage. They aren't able, it's not as permissive in terms of bars and restaurants into the night.
Right.
Obstructive noise limit under the recommended fire version.
I've got some quick questions on policy 225, but I might leave those till tomorrow till I've seen. That's one of the ones you're redrafting, isn't it? You're recommending it be changed?
Yes.
Yes, you've said in paragraph 6A, amending policy 12225.
To add.
Yeah, so I'll wait until I've seen what you've done there.
Sure.
Now, this is an unusual question, I have to admit, but it only apparently discovered it halfway through. Some of your policies end in a full stop and some end in a semicolon. And in some places it appears that you've removed the full stop and put a semicolon in. I'm just wondering if there is a rational reason for that, those changes. In particular, so policy 12236, 12235.
They should have, I mean, they should have full stop, there's no.
Maybe your typist got carried away.
If the full stop's been deleted and the semicolon's been added,
yes.
Very strange.
Okay, there's no significance of that thing.
No, it's not like there's a second point to it that's dropped off or anything.
In policy 12242, H, I think it is. Is it buildings or building mass that is creating the effects in that, that that's referring to?
Building frontages, building extent, I suppose, if you want to say something else on buildings. I mean, the mass in itself, in terms of how deep the site might be and how big the mass of the building is not relevant as such to the shading. If anything, is it's the envelope, you know, the building extent or envelope or height, or this is about the shading that you might enable, might allow by enabling the building to be higher.
So it's the
it's the building envelope, really, isn't it? But really, it's really only at the front, you know, the building frontage.
Well,
the height of the building frontage. It may not be
the frontage, because it may be something that's back from the front, which is still shaded.
Maybe. It's pretty high. But
I'm just going to the rules. And the first thing is that, and it's a matter that perhaps Mr. Winchester might have to address, it's a general thing that some zones in the plan say, I'll find one that says it. That a permitted activity is required to comply with all the standards. That's essentially what it says. It's one of the first explanatory rules. And then it says, as a secondary, it doesn't comply with the standard. Is that permitted, if that permitted activity explanation is necessary, that should be in every zone, presumably. And if it's not in every zone, is it necessary? Should we delete it from the other zones? That's why I said it's not necessarily a question for you.
So in the context of this one, that was submitted on, and there was discussion about...
perhaps I could assist if you looked at page 10.3, which relates to the Arrowtown residential heritage management zone.
Carrotown.
Residential heritage minimal zone. It's chapter 10. Which is a statement of fact, but I accept. But I suppose the question is, should it be in every zone or should it not be in any of them?
It is then supplemented with a specific permitted activity rule. And I suspect it comes back to the exchange you and I had earlier today about default activity status, whereby it's the default activity status is permitted unless it's mentioned elsewhere in the rules, and in other places, if you're not permitted, then you're not complying.
That's
not the default status.
Maybe more important in this zone than where the default is, if you don't, if it's not otherwise mentioned, you're permitted.
Yes.
Okay. Perhaps you can address us on that in reply.
Certainly. Yes.
So I want to make sure that we get that right all the way through the thing.
Yes, it might be.
And it's probably a minor correction.
Could be. In some instances, it might be substantive.
I'll let you consider that.
Yes, and it's probably would want to, in the context of this reply, have a look at how that type of wording is used throughout the plan in general to see what pattern emerges and whether it might be substantive.
Okay.
Thank you.
Now, turning to you in this case, in Rule 1242, which is a controlled activity, and it's a consistent approach that you seem to have taken throughout the rules, I'm wondering whether, instead of saying in respect of after visitor accommodation, it should be consistent with what it says for restricted discretionary and say the matters of control are as follows. While those of us who are expert planners understand in respect of, I'm not sure the general public understand the effect of that. And the first matter of discretion we've got listed here is to do with the town centre guidelines and says where applicable.
Mm-hmm.
Should the rule tell us where it's applicable?
Well, I guess it falls to a policy which says that it requires development to be consistent with the design guideline.
But does a policy have regulatory effect?
I thought it did. I've always taken policies to be part of the regulations. That's the first thing that springs to mind, that it ties in with that policy, which talks about the need to be consistent with design guidelines in the special character area. The other thing, I suppose, where they're applicable is that the guidelines themselves form part of the district plan by reference to the SA design guidelines for the special character area of the Townsend design. And in that respect, that no discretion could simply say that if there's not going to be any others added at any time.
I'm just wondering if that's a little confusing, being the first matter.
So that could save them if they were thinking. It's just the full stop. Then you look at that and see that that only relates to special character. I'd like to special character the other way to say and use the title and actually make it clear in the rule that it was only relates to the special character area.
In paragraph 12.4.7, you've got you set out assessment criteria, essentially there. I'm not complaining about. In the second one, the extent to which any proposed structures or buildings will, I'm just wondering how the use of the term buildings there applies when in the next rule, buildings are made non-complying.
Buildings on walls and jetties are non-compliant.
That's the previous rule.
And if you look at the alignment of the sub-zone, it does extend beyond the walls and jetties. So my take on that would be, we've got all buildings are restricted discretionary. We've got buildings within the
just go back to 12.4.7. The discretionary activity are walls and jetties or commercial surface of water activities. So walls and jetties are definitely structures. No doubt about that. And then the next one, 12.4.8.2, any buildings located on walls and jetties are non-compliant.
Yes, that's a my take on that had been was that buildings within the subzone would be discretionary, buildings on jetties and walls would be non-compliant. But it's essentially come from the ODP. But it begs the question whether 12.4.7 is constrained by walls and walls and jetties only.
Wouldn't buildings be restricted discretionary?
They are overridden by something else.
Yes. Yeah. So 12.4.6. There's nothing other than 12482. There's nothing overriding buildings in that other law in 12487, is there?
No, other than walls and jetties, which are presumably buildings as well. They would, they would get overridden and become discretionary. But I think you're correct that the reference in the assessment manager was it to buildings is superfluous.
Right. And just sort of when I look at those two rules, I see 12.47 and 12.48, it's got the same title, surface of water and interface activities. Is that they're both supposed to have the same?
I can look at, they do both relate to that and they relate to, but they relate to different things within that area, so.
Would it be clearer, and I foreshadow my question by saying that in the rural zone, we have taken all the surface of water rules and put them on their own table. Would it be clearer if the water sub area, or whatever it's called, did have all its rules that are peculiar and particular to itself in a separate table?
Oh.
Or two separate tables, one for the activities and one for the standards.
Let me consider that. I'm not sure if there's enough. I think the idea of improving that, make the titles clearer, is worthwhile for sure, whether there's enough in there to separate out of the secret table or not.
Okay.
Yeah, perhaps I'm only conscious of the transitional subzone as well, you know, being consistent about which ones you find in your own secret table. Now, 12.5.1, I found it confusing, but perhaps you've got comprehensive development defined for the purposes of that role. Yes.
Would it make it more understandable if it says when undertaking a comprehensive development, it says as defined below, so that it's understandable what it is that has been, what the cutoff is?
In the title, you mean?
I mean in 12.5.1.1.
Sure, yes, and that's consistent with 12.5.1.2, mention of as defined below.
Yes, and then I wondered whether you've got the maximum building coverage shall be 75%. And then you go on primarily for the purpose of providing pedestrian links and lanes. Isn't it the remaining 25% that is primarily for the purpose of providing pedestrian links and lanes?
Oh, yes.
Would it be clearer if it said that? And then in 12.5.1.2, I just wondered if it needed to, if it does really need to say for an area of at least 1,400 square metres.
Yes.
given that the definition identifies that as the
Yes, then that's, let me come back to you on that. I think it's probably right. I was considering once adding the definition, which hadn't been there before, whether it's been duplication.
With the matters of discretion, the third bullet point seems very extensive, but it doesn't seem to reflect the matters that you referred to in Rule 12.1. Is there a reason for that?
Well, maybe that the text in 12.5.1.1 is actually sort of, I guess, superfluous and can be dealt with adequately in terms of the matters of discretion rather than potentially turn them up in the rule. The matters of discretion at the appropriate place to have that extra explanatory sort of detail and guidance as to which what matters the council is going to be looking at as to how the 25% should be used.
If you thought that it would be more useful to have assessment matters, I don't think you should be scared of suggesting those to the panel.
I'll check in terms of the question about the points raised in 5.1 and then there's no discretion for that particular rule down below.
Okay. Just turning over to Rule 12.5.7. I'm just wondering.
12.5.7.
That's the one dealing with flood risk. Basements are not a problem?
They can be conditioned in terms of mitigating the risks, in terms of pumping and ensuring that.
But they would be permitted.
No, the ones I'm familiar with are not permitted.
But this rule says that it's only the ground floor, anything below the ground floor is permitted.
Oh, I take it back then, and the ones I've been involved in, I guess they have been, they've always been part of a development and being subject to bigger.
Do you think that the rule maybe should reflect that concern about
the rule that it's another one I'd like to consider a bit further in terms of I mean, they certainly do need to be dealt with in terms of the way they're constructed and sort of flood management, flood management plans and how they're going to operate when there is a flood. But
are you familiar with retail shops, both in New Zealand and overseas, where you use basement areas?
Yes, the one I was most involved in was the Mountaineer building. The work that went into that, the Kathmandu and Quicksilver.
Yes, true, that's quite clear.
Probably in retail shops. But of course, that was a whole package of development that was all being considered very carefully. So if it was just literally a basement, I'd be sure that rule would be effective, that they would think that there are other mechanisms to ensure that risks are mitigated. That's what I'm not sure about. That some sale have a think about Building Act or.
Or is it easier to change the rule?
And just say any floor?
I think the Regional Council's submission on hazards is pretty broad, isn't it?
I'm not sure. Yeah, because no one has been on that particular rule, and the ORC was involved in the creation of it originally, but that's not to say that we can't improve it again if it is needed.
Says there shall be a minimum of 4 metres. And shall be a minimum of 4 metres wide as part of any redevelopment. I'm unsure why as part of any redevelopment is actually there. You know what that
is? No, you're right. I think the wording could be improved on it. I think it should be a minimum of 4 metres wide and as part of any redevelopment where an existing link is covered, then it may remain covered and shall be at least 1.8 metres wide. But I can agree with you that there's no need to have that as part of any redevelopment because that's obviously what's going to trigger the ability to obtain the link anyway.
It's a standard, isn't the requirement that it's
yes,
standard seeking that it just stay 4 metres wide and uncovered?
Yes, so if the whole site was being redeveloped, it was uncovered, it shall remain uncovered. If it was only 3 metres wide, it shall be increased to 4 metres.
Okay, I think there may be, in that case, possibly, would it be easier and more clear if it's stated on redevelopment?
Yeah, I think that is part of any redevelopment or something like that would be the very start, just to clarify to people. I mean, that's kind of obvious, that's a given.
But that was what you need to do. Yes, because that intention that you suggested wasn't clear. I just had difficulty with the provision at the end of the first sentence, which says takes precedent over the general descriptions below. I'm not quite sure what geographic descriptions it's referring to.
No.
And
I've struck out the general description, such as eastern side of Brisbane Street, as one example.
Right.
In 12.592.
Yes.
So
you're right.
It can be struck out as a consequence of that.
The other question I have on that is, it's not clear. Well, the heading says it relates to Precinct 1 and 1A, but the rule itself doesn't say that. So the maximum height could be 12 metres.
Okay, so you'd really prefer to be the Duke to state that again? Yeah.
I think so. Certainly in the next rule, 12.5.10.1, it says 1A2 have absolute limits. I think it would just be clearer to the user if that was consistent. And then across the page, this is in the diagrams of 12.5.10.1D. We've got the parapet on the north side between 6.5 and 7 metres high. And then there's a recession line. How can you have a parapet that's 7 metres high when the recession plane commences at 6.5 metres?
Well, by setting the building back is the only way, and some of them, and that's what they've been required to do thus far, but now they won't be required to cut, they won't be required to set the building back off the street.
Isn't Mr. Church's evidence that that's not desirable to set?
That's right, and that's why I agree with that, and that's why we removed it.
Yes, but now they're still requiring it.
If you want to do a parapet that goes through the recession plane, then you'll need to set it back. Then you need to set the whole building back.
But I thought parapets were desirable.
Well, Ms. Gilly said it was... I need to go back and I'm just going off conversations with her and previous drafts of evidence, but it wasn't a strong... I thought on that street she said that there wasn't a lot of original fabric on Beach Street, and it wasn't a strong character element through there, but I need to double check that.
So at a 30 degree angle, how much further? That would be about 800 mils?
Yeah, so it's that, and that's what the setback was.
Would that, from an urban design point of view, does that make for a good character on the street to have 800 mil setback?
No, in my opinion it doesn't, and it's why we're now enabling them to go closer to the road. But they do need to, as we initially had them being able to continue to protrude through the recession plane with the parapet, but the shading was significantly worse with that extra half metre.
So she'll
fall right on the street. So,
should the parapets be removed then?
Well, they could be. Adelia's advice was that they weren't essential to character. They did provide some, this is from my recollection, they did provide some interest. But they weren't essential. We didn't need to tailor-make all the rules around it to make sure that that occurred. Those were provided. So it's an option now rather than mandated that you must set back. I mean, you can have a parapet up to there, but now you can build right on the road, which is our preference from an urban design perspective and for all the reasons that both Mr. Church and I stated.
If you only had the rule that was 6.5 metres and a 30 degree incline, do you need to mention parapets?
Well,
because if someone wants to build one, they can set back and comply.
You probably, yes, I mean, there's no way we can just buy, we're not providing any incentive to do it as such, but they still need to. They still need to be within the parapet and the recession lane. So we're always really encouraging or discouraging them.
Well, on the face of it, it looks inconsistent. The rules and the policies.
I'd probably like to get some further advice from the Gillies and check and the Vibra Fire whether that's something that if people are providing parapets, whether there's any any positive benefits in the mandating that they must be between 6.5 and 7 metres, for example, in height. Something like that that's beyond my expectation. I felt that's really important that they do a parapet, it does need to be at that height. Or, you know.
But if they went back, they set back 1.5 metres, so presumably it goes even close to 8 metres.
Yes, yeah, the height, the building height could, that's right, so that's where that.
And you could have a parapet, because that would still comply with the, comply with everything else, wouldn't it?
Well, yes, it would involve the parapet.
Is it? If the desire is that parapets are no more than 0.5 metre high and no more than 7 metres, then that perhaps is a totally different issue from the setback, from the recession planes, and maybe the two are confused by having them together like that.
Maybe. No, they were together traditionally because it was the point was that they were allowed to protrude through and taking that away because we just can't aid away.
Okay. Now, in Rule 12.5.11, that's 12.5.11.2, that I'm wondering whether that should be a rule or should it be a note. And I ask that question because Rule 14.5.8 has a note that the sound from out of from the zone received in other zones is controlled by the provisions of the receiving zone in Chapter 36. Which has the same effect.
Sorry, which other rule are you referring to?
14.5.8. In the Arrowtown Town Centre.
Oh, okay. And to me, it's an important part of the rule framework because it's essentially imposing another, is imposing quite a different rule.
Well, the rule's imposed in Chapter 36.
And that's what I was about to say, but then actually in Chapter 36, you know, to clarify the rule that makes it clear that news generated in the town centre, the events from Chapter 36, except that, you know, generated here and received somewhere else, then it shall comply with the adjacent zone.
Yes.
Limits, which, yeah, means.
Well, in the Arrowtown, what I'm getting to is in the Arrowtown Town Centre, that is actually a note, although it's wrongly listed as an exemption, but it's actually a note. And I'm wondering which one is the appropriate way to go.
I think, provided that the consistencies between Chapter 12 and 36 are sorted out, then that is duplicated with Chapter 36 rules, and we could have it as a note. It should still be there, a note, but then the note should probably read similar to the Arrowtown one.
It could incorporate the Chapter 36 rule
reference.
It's actually a table. Yes, but there's a rule with a table in Chapter 36 would be the appropriate way to do it, presumably.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Probably. I mean, they're all yeah, saying the same thing, but differently. So it's
okay. In the same rule, but that's 12-15 11, and that's the exemptions, sorry, to that rule. The second bullet point, we've got outdoor public events, as if those events that are permitted pursuant to Chapter 35 or Well, Chapter 35 deals with a whole lot of events. Is it the ones that are permitted or allowed or consented or something? It just seemed that it needed some sort of descriptor to relate the events to Chapter 35.
Yes, so I mean, the way this read, I need to go back and look at Dr. Charles Evans to his intention here as to whether, and you can consider that, whether it really was only for permitted outdoor public events. My reflection was it was that in respect of noise, it was for all outdoor public events. So it didn't have to be, I can't call the constraints of them, whether it was 200 people or outdoors or indoors.
At some point they became
criteria, but my reflection was
the noise combined, but I'll come back to you in that. In 12.5.14, you recommend the removal. Is it the entire rule that you recommend removal, or just the...
No, it's just the skinnies and heading cells to limit the effects on the night sky.
We do have a submission on the night sky, but it's actually seeking there be more limitation of the adverse effects on the lights on view of the night sky. So
yes,
the only submission we have on the issue is actually contrary to that.
Well, yeah, we were discussing a consistent approach, almost consistent advice to the panel in regards to that, whether it should be that it's that there's no scope that we recommend removing it, or whether we're arguing that it's self-revised of no effect and therefore can be struck out without further process. So it's not something we
I'm not sure that it's self-revised. The Mackenzie district have a similar control in tempo. Yes, well, I think you should have a look at these submission. I think it was by Mr. Hughes on that matter. He presented evidence in the rural chapter, I think it was. But it was a district-wide submission. Final question on this. In your non-notification provisions, in 12.6.1.1, at the in the residential hearings, I'm pretty sure it was, there was a discussion with Mr. McColl from NZTA about this, and he accepted that deemed was not appropriate. But he did accept that being considered an official party would satisfy NZTA.
Yes, that's my intention of certainly not suggesting that they shall be deemed or assigned, just to enable the the council to consider it case by case and not have to find special circumstances if they did want to serve another song.
Yes, that's right. So I think it's within the scope of the Act to define that certain persons will be always considered to be an affected party when they have the adjoining land.
Well, I mean, in this instance, one thing of the effectiveness would just would be not that we're always saying they're affected, but just that there's not a non-notification clause that immediately
precludes
them from being notified. So it's not saying they shall be notified every time, it's saying
Well, if they had to be considered, then you'd have to consider whether they are affected or not. If claim says they're affected, then and they've granted approval for the access, then they've granted approval for the purpose of notification in any event. I'll leave that one with you. Must have one just to ponder. Yes.
Just on my colleague's question before about character buildings, is it? Landmark buildings?
Mm-hmm.
And wondering whether or not it could actually become part of the term census place, or whether or not that would open it up too broadly. But there's a... No, I've changed pages, sorry. Census place, a list of... points that make it sense of place.
Under the policy,
yeah, 12.2.2. Low rise character buildings is one of the terms used, and whether or not.
Yeah, I do.
Landmark building would be included in that, or would still be too restrictive.
That one only, that particular advice one only relates to the objective and policy there. Doesn't capture everywhere that I've mentioned landmark buildings. But yeah, consider that and put that wider issue of it not being clearly defined what we mean by that.
While I recommend the majority of the provisions of notified chapter 13 be retained generally as notified, I also recommend a number of amendments in my section 42A report. These revised provisions are considered to be more effective and efficient than the notified version and an appropriate means of achieving the purpose of the RMA and the strategic direction of the purpose of the PDP. The revised provisions achieve this through objectives that provide the Wānaka Town Centre to continue to evolve as the principal commercial, entertainment and cultural centre for the wider Wānaka area in a manner that enables the community to provide for its social and economic well-being while appropriately managing effects on character and amenity. And through policies and rules that enable some intensification through relaxing height and coverage in parts of the town centre, require high quality development through design control and guidelines, maintain a human scale throughout the Wānaka Town Centre and allow an increase in noise in parts of the town while ensuring the effects on sensitive uses are minimised. I've recommended several changes to the proposed provisions in order to better achieve the purpose of the RMA, with the key changes recommended being a minor amendment to policy 32.31 and a small extension of the High Crescent zoning in Planning Act 21. As outlined in paragraphs 8 and 9 of this summary, I'm now recommending further revisions to that precinct in response to submitted evidence. More restrictive noise limits on those sites north of Ardmore Street, redraft rule 13510, a new maximum building coverage rule in relation to developments covering an area of more than 1400 square metres, redrafted rule 13513, imposing a requirement to provide a comprehensive development plan and to develop no more than 75% of the site to buildings. A minor amendment to notify policy 13261 to acknowledge that traffic and car park management are integral to enhancing pedestrian amenity. A minor amendment to notify policy 13221 to further clarify the role of the town centre transition overlay. And a minor amendment to notify rule 13.44 relating to discretion over natural hazards when considering consents for buildings. In summary, the provisions recommended are considered to be more appropriate and that the noise limits will provide for a reasonable level of amenity within the adjacent residentially zoned land. The height extension is logical and result in urban design benefits and slightly greater intensification, flexibility and efficient land use within the existing town centre zone boundaries, and the requirement to provide a comprehensive development plan and adhere to a maximum building coverage when developing land over 1400 square metres in the area will result in improved urban design outcomes, including comprehensively planned larger scale developments and the provision of pedestrian links and or semi-public spaces, a finer grained built form, service lanes and view shafts as appropriate for each particular development site. Pursuant to the panel's minute entitled Minute Concerning One Height Precinct, dated November 6th, Appendix 1 to this evidence summary lists those submissions that have been reallocated from the mapping hearing to this hearing. As such, all submissions relating to the Height Precinct within the One Town Centre will now be considered as part of this hearing. I note that all other submissions relating to One Height Precinct were assigned to this hearing stream from the outset, and that these three additional submissions are essentially duplicates of those which have already been addressed in the 42A report. Therefore, no further assessment is required and has not been necessary to serve notice of any additional submissions. Having considered the evidence filed by Mr. Ian Greaves and Ms. Lily Wright on behalf of Gem Lake Limited, I also recommend creating a second height precinct and applying this to those sites fronting Howick Street south of the Dunmore Street intersection, and also to those sites within the height precinct included in my section 42A recommended chapter. I'd just like to explain there, those, when I talk about those sites within the height precinct, I'm referring to sites, or it's clear from the map attached, but I'm referring to the sites within the notified height precinct which front Dunmore Street and are shown as the green outline in the map.
So that's the additional area.
Pardon?
Does that include the additional area on Howick Street as well? Is that
the eastern side, the whole of the eastern side of Howick Street is new from the notified version?
Yes.
The green on the eastern side of Howick Street and the green on the western side of Howick Street, south of Dunmore Street,
yes,
is also new.
Yes.
Newly recommended, and the area on the northern side of Dunmore Street, on Howick,
yes,
was notified as being within the height precinct, 12 to 14 metre height precinct.
Right.
And I'm now recommending that actually go down to this new height precinct too.
Okay.
With the benefit of the shading material, the advice or information that we've been privy to. The amendment is shown in the amended planning act attached to Appendix 2. Rule 13.59 would also be amended to include height precinct 2, within which a height of 10 metres to the eave and 12 metres to the ridgeline and up to a maximum of 3 stories would be enabled. It's acknowledged that this amendment will not necessarily encourage significantly greater intensification or land use efficiency within the Wanaka Town Centre, and that a partial third story can already be achieved within the 8 to 10 metre height limit and may in fact result in slightly less intensification than under the proposed height plan due to the recommended reduction in height on Dunmore Street. However, in my view, this option will more appropriately achieve objective 13.24 regarding quality of urban design outcomes, and it will enable higher quality internal spaces with more flexibility and more generous stud heights reinforce Halbert Street's role as the main retail street and evolving role as the entryway into the one of the town centre, and encourage its redevelopment while resulting in only minor shading effects. Shading effects and a desire to strengthen the perimeter block of the notified height precinct were the primary reason for reducing the notified permitted height on those sites facing Dunmore Street. In coming to the recommendations outlined above, I rely on evidence of Ms. Wright and discussions with Mr. Timothy Church. I also note that since filing here, Ms. Wright has prepared additional shading diagrams which illustrate the extent of shading that would occur from various height scenarios at 12:30 p.m. on the 11th of July and on the 11th of August. I've had the benefit of seeing these diagrams and they assisted me in coming to my advised position. I understand these additional diagrams will be tabled at the hearing by Ms. Wright. For completeness, I wish to add the following points of clarification in relation to my 42A report. With regard to paragraph 13.8, I note that a challenging health check was undertaken by RPG at the time of the plan change 16 hearing and was presented as evidence at that time. That report concluded that based on the matters to be considered as part of the health check, the town centre was in a healthy state. And I acknowledge that contrary to my comment in paragraph 9.11 of my section 42A report, I will state that a building would be subject to a different resistance and activity status depending on whether its design had been reviewed by the design panel or not, would not be able to provide. Nevertheless, for effectiveness and efficiency reasons, as outlined in paragraph 13.24 of the Queenstown Town Centre 42A report, I continue to recommend that the rule requested is inappropriate. I've recalculated my early estimates of the additional capacity enabled by the height precinct now being recommended. The key changes are that in order to estimate the capacity that existed under the PDP without the height precinct, I've relied on the more recent McDermott-Miller report rather than the much earlier one for commercial land needs study. And I produced the theory for additional GFA enabled by the recommended height precincts to reflect the recommended reduction in building heights on the sites facing Dunmore Street to 10/12 metres, which essentially means that they were not necessarily enabling the extra development capacity that is achievable under the notified PDP. These calculations suggest that introducing the recommended height precincts will result in no more than a 5% increase in theoretical capacity within the Wanaka Town Centre. With regard to submitters' concerns about traffic congestion and parking issues resulting from the increase in height, my view expressed in the section 42 out of 4 has therefore not changed.
We've got 6 minutes. Commissioner Rogers. Yeah, and don't worry if you don't finish your questions. No, but I probably won't. But I'm sorry, I just didn't quite follow the reasoning behind the reduction in height that you're talking about on Dunmore Street. That's detailed in Appendix 2. So
yes.
Just take me through that again.
So, reasoning it'll become, I just wanted to, I think now is an opportunity to raise the issue with the panel, and my reasoning will become a little clearer when you just write evidence on behalf of one of the submitters. But essentially, having seen her shading diagrams, it's clear that the 12 to 14 metre height does cause some shading to the south, as you'd expect.
And what is it actually shading? I couldn't.
So it's shading. It's shading Dunmore Street. It's what we would consider and have decided to be quite critical times of the day and year. So under, I appreciate you haven't got the diagrams in front of you at this point, but under the 10 to 12 metre height maximum, there is still some strip of sunny footpath at 12:30 in July and considerably so in August. But once we got up to that 12/14 metres, that shading around that lunchtime period is fully covering the footpath. on Dunmore, and that's, you know,
on the south side of Dunmore.
On the south side of Dunmore Street. And our criteria that we used for Queenstown, and we didn't see why Wanaka should be any different, was that in the middle of the lunchtime period, in those sort of not depth of winter months, but July, August, whenever, if it's in the sun at 12:30 in the IUP, ultimately we would like to keep it in the sun. You know, we wanted to test how much could we push those heights without jeopardising that access to sunlight.
Sure. Okay.
So that was the sole reason, really, was the shading.
Right. So that deals with the aspect on Dunmore Street, but what about on Helvick Street, is it?
Yes, yeah. And similarly, that was my reasoning for not recommending to go right to the 12 to 14 metre height, the length of Dunmore, because of its angle, there is shading onto that footpath if you go to...
And is it the same shading issue for Pembroke Lane, is that the reason why?
Pembroke Lane will be shaded as a result of either of these, I believe.
Perhaps Ms. Jones explained what Pembroke Lane is.
But Pembroke Lane is primarily a service lane. I mean, it is a service lane at this point in time. If it morphs into a little bit more of a hybrid use, maybe, but at the moment it's a service lane. It's back of house, the New World. It's not lending itself to this is becoming a pedestrian way over, I mean, it does provide more pedestrian access, which is great, but Mr. Church wasn't, he had huge concerns about that.
Alrighty. Alright, that's me for now.
I think the sensible thing would be to return 10 a.m. tomorrow morning. Have you made similar amendments to policies in the Wanaka Town Centre Zone that are not in your section for today was for?
No.
No, so it's only that, the only change is that change here.
Yes, and
quite consequential, like recent one, quite recent one, not quite recent one, for example.
Yeah,
so
no, what you see from
you
is pretty much it.
We might need to see some modified rules, but I think those could wait for the reply. I think it's more important that things that are substantive, but we're in the Queenstown Town Centre, if I've seen my thing.
So, too, yeah.
Just keep for the gym till 10 a.m. tonight.